Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me this afternoon is a good friend of the show,
Nathan Velasquez.
Well, look at there. You can actually pronounce your last name. Jordy yeah. Can.
Yes, that was pretty funny. At first, we kind of talked about that a little bit on the Real Friends pod, the other movie podcast we do for 104.5 ESPN. And yeah, we talked about how Jordy Can't. He says Velasquez, which apparently is okay. That's kind of the American pronunciation. But, you know, sometimes it's funny to dig at people, say that. But yes, Velasquez, correct. It's funny. It's
funny. Indeed. So tell us a little bit about yourself, about your love for movies, and why you wanted to be on the podcast.
Yeah, well, I guess you and I met through the ESPN 104.5 Off the Bench show that's on. We just started talking about movies. I love movies. I mean, I've been a movie lover for my entire life. I own a advertising production company, which I started because I, you know, have a few cameras. I love filming, so pretty much do whatever I can to make money with a camera, and that's pretty much all I'll look up, things like that. So movies are kind of through and through for me.
I sound like a young J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, I need to spend more time making short films, trying to get into festivals, but, you know, doing it for money is fine right now. Making ads for people is good as well.
I mean, I think that the beautiful thing about cinema is that it is an interpretive medium and it sparks conversation. I can go and I can watch The Good Shepherd. I think The Good Shepherd is a fantastic film that has a lot to say, especially in this time period that we're in now, about the CIA and about intelligence and about, you know, the history of the CIA.
That's a heartbreaking movie.
It is.
That scene where they... Well, I guess I don't know if we should spoil it. But the scene where they throw her out of the plane is one of the most heartbreaking moments that I remember seeing. I guess I was pretty young when that came out, but that left a big impact on me.
Yeah, that and, like, the fact that ultimately Good Shepherd is a tragedy of a man who was trapped not only in this field that he never intended to get into, but trapped in a marriage that he never wanted with a child that he never wanted, and to some extent always held resentment toward, because he felt like he was chained to this relationship and that this child prevented him from having the life that he was supposed to have. And, you know, Angelina Jolie, I think, gives one of her better performances of her career.
That was a good, the 2000s were a really good decade for her.
Yeah, that was a really good movie. Eddie Redmayne also gives a very good performance in that as
very
the best.
Surprising. Matt Damon does a pretty good job, which, you know, sometimes it feels like people can be a little sniffy about Matt Damon, but I think he really turned a new side of himself there.
And De Niro as
I forgot, as a
director.
That. Yeah.
Something he hasn't done a lot of since, because he's, you know, too busy making Bad Grandpa and War with Grandpa and every other kind of...
What was the last really great performance that he was in? It's been...
Well, we're all hoping it's The Irishman.
That's true. He was pretty good in Wizard of Lies. I thought that the HBO thing was pretty good.
I mean, but you talk to a lot of people about Good Shepherd, and they think that it's a horrible movie, that it's not well made, that, you know, that it's kind of pointless.
It's one of the people will immediately say that it's slow, which it is, but it kind of knows what it's doing. Like, it's okay that it's slow.
Right. And it has a lot to say. Mm-hmm. And it's taking place over decades.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, in its own way, it's a Shakespearean tragedy of a man, of two lovers who were never able to be together.
Yeah. I need to watch it again. It's been quite a few years. I don't think I could talk about what exactly goes on throughout the whole movie, but it is good. It's a powerful watch.
Yeah, if you're doing spy movies, that's one that you definitely would want to have up there.
Yeah. What is that? Because the novel, I forget what novel that is based
on. I don't know what novel it's based on, but I know that...
I forget who the writer of that.
Shortly after that movie came out, Legacy of Ashes, the book on the history of the CIA, came out.
It might not even be...
It's like circa 2007.
It is actually... No, it's not written based... I mean, it's not based on a book. I thought it was.
Mm-mm. That was De Niro. All De Niro.
Very impressive.
Very, very impressive for a debut film, yeah. Which he never went back to directing or writing.
That is true. Well, it looks like who? Eric Roth. I'm not sure what else he did. Looks like he wrote it. But yeah, you're right. De Niro has not directed since.
Nope.
That's surprising.
Mm-hmm. But like, that's what I love about film. We can have conversations and different viewpoints on different things. And even, you know, and there are certain filmmakers like a Joe Wright, like a Zack Snyder, like, you know, there are certain directors that are Ridley Scott, where the film, like, community has a differentiating opinion on
yeah.
it. And you can have a conversation about their body of work that doesn't break down into, you know, anger and resentment and, like, you know, partisanship, the way that so many other conversations in our current culture.
It's very frustrating having conversations with some people whenever you have differing opinions and they don't really... I mean, they like movies, and that might just be as far as it goes. They like movies. And if you have a different opinion than some people, they get so pissed off at you.
Especially in the nerd community.
Yeah, that's true. Like, if you're going to give an opinion, you have to, like, start by saying, well, I mean, it's my opinion. Or, you know, this is just what I think. Like, of course, it's just what you think. But, yes, movies are great. I also love reading. I love novels. But there's some way, like, the best movies will hit you, and they'll hit you in a certain way that sometimes I feel like a book isn't able to.
The most beautiful thing to me about film is that you, when it's done right with a good story, it brings characters to life and it makes them feel real and it makes them feel relevant and vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of blowback. My favorite, we've talked about this many times, my best picture of the year is Lady Bird. It won't win, and Greta's not going to walk away with best director. But a lot of the blowback is, well, that's just a film for females in their 30s who want to get all up in their feels, and like, it's really paint by numbers and not that great. But like, to me, that character speaks a lot to the time period, to what kids were going through at that particular point. Her issues are real issues.
Not even, yeah. I mean, it feels... I thought it was incredibly relevant even... I know it's not about, you know, a man. But a lot of that, the relationship with a parent, having one parent who you always fight with no matter what, and then having the one parent that'll come and comfort you, or dealing with people who are going through feelings of, you know, they don't know what sexuality they are, kind of confused about that. Finding out that someone that you know is a sexual identity that you didn't expect, and how to deal with that when you were first realizing that that could hit close to home. I think to say that it's just for women is pretty simplistic or childish, I think.
Right. And I think it's interesting and powerful. And it's honestly one of the reasons that I love professional wrestling. I'm sitting here wearing a WrestleMania t-shirt. It's...
Who is that, by the way? What number do you have on 33? 33. Okay.
This was last 33? Year's. This was last year's, just the jersey from WrestleMania 33.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
For me, like, there are certain performers
mm-hmm.
who, it doesn't matter what the buildup is. It doesn't matter what the storylines are. You put those two people in a ring for 35 minutes and they can tell you a story that will take you on the full roller coaster of emotions from, you know, joy to sadness to shock to awe, and will give you a good resolution. And it's like, that's what I love about the power of character and story, that, you know, you don't necessarily have to have 1,000 years of pathos or 50 years of comic book history or, you know, a great book that you're basing your work on.
Mm-hmm.
You can create wholly new characters, and if you're telling a compelling, interesting narrative with good character work, it can move people. And that's, I think, the two greatest things film does is it empowers and it informs. And
it does so completely visually, which I think kind of hits it, whenever it resonates, it, I think, at least for me, will hit at your memory in a way that... I'm not sure another art form does, you know, sound, visuals. I thought that, because I watched Three Billboards yesterday, I think, like, 20, 30 years from now, if a young person or whoever comes across that movie, they don't have trailers, they might just watch it on whatever streaming service we're all using then. The first scene wherever she looks at those billboards and they're completely blank, they're old, she looks at him from her car, bites at her nail. You can tell that she's racked with, you don't know if it's guilt, whatever it is, but you can tell that there's a pain there. Like, within 5 minutes, that movie has established more with complete silence than, the way that it does that. It hits really hard. And yeah, it's an example a modern example of a movie with, you know, beautiful storytelling, silent storytelling in a way that only film can do.
Well, and look at a lot of what Joe Wright does in Atonement. The way that he frames things. I mean,
I've got to say, I need to see that again. I was not a fan of Atonement when I first saw it. I know that you love it. I know that you love it, and I need to watch it again.
I love it for a lot of the same reasons that I love The Good Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautifully told story about tragedy.
He does history well. Yeah. He gives texture to history in a way that I don't think it's easy to make boring period pieces.
Which is something that he has not done, whether it be Pride and Prejudice, whether it be Anna Karenina.
Anna Karenina is powerful. That might be my favorite of his.
It's powerful. I don't understand why it didn't land. I think people got too caught up in the visuals. And
I think that proscenium arch thing, it feels like it's in the theater. It feels kind of... I think that was a bold choice, which I think will help in the long run, but... At the time, I don't think that helped.
But imagine a kid who's a freshman at LSU right now, mm-hmm. in communication studies, yeah. or in film or English or whatever, sitting down and watching that tracking shot of McAvoy.
Oh, the Dunkirk scene.
The Dunkirk scene, walking down the beach and just seeing this mass of humanity,
mm-hmm.
and just imagine like the technical work that had to go to frame. To framing that and to making it a reality, it just, you know, that shot tells a story that within and of itself of a country at its weakest moment.
Yeah.
And then the resolution there at the end where she's like, yeah, this is how I would have liked for it to be. This isn't the way that it happened. And I've had to live with this all of my life, but this is the way I wish it would have been.
Mm.
Because otherwise she's doomed herself to, she sent two people to their deaths. You know, he ends up dying in the house waiting for his evacuation, and she ends up dying in an underground bunker trying to have safety from the bombing of London.
The ending is, well, very well done.
Very well executed, because you never see it coming, because your thought process is what you're seeing it play out, mm-hmm. is happening in real time. In the child molestation story, also, you know, very tricky territory there, but like he pulls it off masterfully. And for as much grief as he gets for Pan, which to me honestly is
I've not taken the time to go through that yet.
A beautifully stunning, unique retelling of the Pan story that is better than I think most people will ever give it credit for, but it's not paint by numbers by any stretch. And that's what I like most about it. You know, the uniqueness of Hugh Jackman hamming it up and,
mm-hmm.
You know, the uniqueness of just the structure and the way that Pan comes about becoming Pan. You know, again, the period piece of that time in London, and the way that he recreates that.
Yeah.
Is all very good, but
that was even a movie where beforehand weren't people talking about how that was a novel that couldn't be done, like one of those unfilmable books.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I mean, I saw it when did it come out? 2007.
What, Atonement?
Yeah,
yeah, it was 2008, 2007.
Okay. I was probably way too young to try that movie out, but I mean, it's definitely well done. It's beautiful. The structure is pulled off really well. I haven't read the book, but I can tell that people afterwards were not saying, ha, he didn't do it, because he did definitely pull it off.
And he's gotten the best performances of Keira Knightley's career.
That's true. She's gotten better. She's gotten better in the last few years, but that was definitely one of the first times.
He's brought her to that, because from Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, that's true.
From Pride and Prejudice to Atonement to Anna Karenina, like, he's brought her along.
Also, Saoirse Ronan. I mean, has she ever... She's never really put a foot wrong. I mean, well, what was the host? She was not great in The Host.
She was not... But nothing was great about The Host. Nothing was great about The Host. Hannah, which they're about to do a TV series for, another Joe Wright film.
I think that movie helped him a lot.
That movie helped...
I think that was good for his career.
But she did well in Hannah, mm-hmm. which if it came out now, everybody would be clamoring for more because it's a female-driven empowerment story.
Good point. That was before we even had the Oscars So White thing.
Right. And, you know, Cate Blanchett hamming it up as a villain and the whole nine yards. But, like, he had her in Atonement where she got her first nomination.
Yeah.
And then he had her again in Hannah. And that those films kind of lay the groundwork for what she does in Brooklyn and Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the irony that she was up for Rey in Star Wars.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So.
Wait, was she?
She was. They met with, like, a bunch of actresses for that.
Oh, I imagine so, yeah.
Yeah, and the hardest part for them was they were trying to cast someone without a script. Because JJ and Gaston were putting the thing together as they went, but
well, I'm sure JJ wasn't afraid of that.
Never is. So let's dive into some actual, you know, stuff that we came here to talk about. So there was a Super Bowl. There was a lot of parties, people consuming food and alcohol, and nerds watching because they needed to geek out over commercials. One such commercial was the Netflix commercial, letting the world know that they had acquired a new Cloverfield movie called Cloverfield Paradox. And that it was dropping immediately after the Super Bowl. Your thoughts on the marketing strategy of the surprise, you know, and this movie will be available in 3 hours, and what it means for the industry that Netflix can go to Paramount and be like, you don't want to release this in the theaters, we'll buy it from you for a fraction of what it costs you to make, and we'll put it on our streaming service.
Well, I think that's one of the positive things about Netflix is how quickly it can move. Like, then at Sundance just now, they bought that movie, The Ritual. And, you know, usually you buy a movie at Sundance, you know, you'll see it in about 7-8 months. Like, that was out. Sundance has, you know, not even been over a week. And that's,
It's been over about a month.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, Sundance is mid-January always.
It's finished? Huh, that's strange. Anyway, it was fast. It was fast.
Oh, what was the Nate, the one that was the two slavery movies that were supposed to come out a couple of years ago, Free State of Jones, and then what was the other one?
Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation, which coming out of Sundance had all the Oscar buzz,
right.
And then you find out the history of the guy who made it.
That was not very good.
And it dies on arrival. But they bought that at Sundance, and they held it till September and October, which is generally what you do with those.
Right. But yeah, they went ahead, they put it right out, and that's kind of an exciting thing with Netflix, is how quickly it can move. I thought, whenever I saw that it fit perfectly. Like, what, 10 Cloverfield Lane, we got two months' notice?
1 month.
1 month. Yeah. 1 month's notice, which fits perfectly with that whole mystery box thing that J.J. Abrams loves to do. So whenever he saw it, I thought it was incredibly exciting. You know, that was Sunday night, I had a few drinks in me, I was going to have to go to bed early for the radio show. I had to stay up that night, watch it. Because I was excited. I was really excited. And I thought it fit. In terms of marketing, I did not take the time to think if that could have been a preemptive thing for however the movie might be. I was excited, and they got my blood boiling in a good sense over marketing.
They drove you to a computer to watch this movie after a football game.
I will say, after seeing the movie, it did seem like they took the opportunity to maybe have a few articles come out the next day that, you know, Netflix has numbers spiking like it never saw before. You know, so many people logged on right after the Super Bowl, things like that. But no, I was incredibly excited. I was downtown at the Bengal Tap Room. And yeah, when that came on, everyone was like, right after this, we've got to get home. Like, people were excited.
What do you think it means for the industry that they are bailing studios out? Is they've just together did this with Cloverfield Paradox, which was previously God Particle, which they bought off of Paramount. They negotiated with Paramount to get the international rights to Annihilation, which Paramount is skeezy on.
Yeah.
Now, the early reviews are out of the park, but The concern is that when they release this thing in a couple of weeks domestically, it's not going to take, and then they wanted Netflix to bail them out on the international. And so they negotiated and gave Netflix the rights to the international distribution on that. They just picked up another kind of off the radar film from another studio that they didn't want to Universal was scared about releasing, and so they bought
what
it off.
What movie is that?
I don't remember. It was like a snow tinged horror movie of some kind.
Huh.
But like, what do you make of Netflix bailing studios out and studios being willing to work with them, given the current conditions of like where the art form is, where it's like streaming versus in theater experience?
In terms of I guess that thing, Christopher Nolan has been talking about that a lot, the whole thing about how, you know, watching it on Netflix, it's not watching it in the theater, that's why he'll never do it, it's a different experience, it's TV. Which it feels like there's a weird double-sided thing to Netflix. Like, on one end you have the creative, you know, type of, what do you call it, like an incubation type of thing where people like David Fincher, Martin Scorsese can work on these projects with gigantic budgets where they have complete creative control, which is great. For people like that, that's great and exciting because you know how long they fight for things like that. But then there's also, and I think the Cloverfield Paradox thing falls into like a dumping ground for content for studios like this or independent movies. Like, do you watch South Park?
Yeah.
Do you remember that last episode in the last season whenever people call into Netflix and they say, hey, it's Netflix, you're greenlit, what's your pitch?
Yeah.
It feels like they need content. Like, there's a lot of stuff that comes out that feels okay, but it feels like it's just, you know, maybe it's a Wednesday afternoon, you want to watch something, there's a new Netflix movie out. Like, it feels almost like a little bit better than TV movies, but not quite TV movies. Like, not quite movies, not TV movies, somewhere in between sometimes.
Right.
That's what I think. I mean, it's nice, and it feels almost like they haven't really found, you know, the rhythm yet, almost, because like what House of Cards was the big thing when we realized, you know, Netflix can actually put their own stuff out. When did that start? That started
like 2010, I think. 2010, 2011, something like that.
So it's still pretty new. Like 10 years from now, streaming services could look completely different.
Well, I mean, they were fed originally by the studios because they were contracting right with all the studios to basically be a physical warehouse and then eventually a streaming warehouse for all of your different stuff.
Like, Disney's catching up to them.
Yeah. Well, Disney and Netflix are going to be in a war for a little while. Yeah. We'll talk about that here in a second. But, like, for me, it's problematic because, you know, I could see you getting away with doing this in, like, 2008. Where, mm-hmm. like, they're just starting up their streaming service. They need content. You're unsure about this movie. You sell it off to them. You know, they get a spike, but, you know, you don't have to take the financial risk. And, you know, it works out for everybody. The problem is Netflix is now a streaming giant.
Oh, yeah.
That is to the point where they do not have to adhere to releasing data.
Yeah.
So they are your direct competition. Them, along with Amazon, are keeping people out of the theater.
Which, I mean, a side thing, which do you prefer in terms of streaming? Would you rather go with Netflix or Amazon?
Amazon's putting out more critically acclaimed content and more dramatic content, both on the TV side and
right.
the movie side. I like Netflix for the nostalgia plays. The mm-hmm. fourth season of The Arrested Development, which was god-awful, but it still exists because it exists because Netflix was willing to do something that Fox was not.
Right.
Fox was not willing to give them money to do it. Something like Freaks and Geeks would have lived on for at least a couple of more years if a Netflix type thing had been mm-hmm. around, because Netflix would have gladly picked up a show with a cult following, undeclared the same way. They would have picked it up and kept feeding it, kept, you know, giving them money to make those.
Which we do have a Netflix Oscar nominated movie,
right?
Mudbound. Let's
If Mudbound came out under Focus Features banner, it would have gotten a lot more awards play.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I feel there is still even with the changeover, massive changeover in voting block. Mm-hmm. I still think there's an inherent Netflix bias because, you know, what was that the African slave children movie that came out a couple of years ago.
Oh, Beast of No Nation.
Beast of No Nation.
That was very good.
Well, very good. But like, there were like maybe two or three stars holding screenings at their house trying to get this thing some Oscar push, and it just died.
Oh, and what? I guess I didn't think about it before. I mean, in the end, Netflix really is, you know, Oscars are, we love watching the Oscars. We love what that means for conversation about movies. Like, really, it's a big deal in a business type of sense. Like, in the big run, I don't think it's a huge deal in terms of how people digest their movies. Like, for some people, I'm sure it is. But, you know, Netflix is in people's homes where people can watch them. People aren't going to see the movies that Focus Features are putting out because, I mean, people aren't going to the movies that much anymore. They all have Netflix, though. They have the Mudbounds on their TV ready to watch tonight.
Right. And that's my concern with just being like, here, pay us $50 million, you can take this off our hands, no problem. Right. Well, now they've got a huge surge in new membership because, you know, everybody needed to see this Cloverfield movie, and now they're signed up for at least 2 months. And, like, so they've gotten more subscribers because you helped them. Like,
oh, yeah.
You do not need to be helping them. You need to be generating good content so that you give people a reason to go to the movies.
I do kind of wonder, why would it be that they wanted for Netflix to take... Why do they want someone to take it off their hands? Simply because, I mean, they're not going to be afraid of... They're not going to be afraid of putting out a bad movie. Just because, I mean, they do it before. They do it all the time.
But the budget was so far out of whack that even the generated buzz you would get from attaching the Cloverfield name to it would not have done Cloverfield Lane numbers, and that's probably what you would have had to have done to turn a profit on that film.
Well,
Netflix
it
doesn't...
It costs $40 million? I feel like they could have gotten to 80.
Well, Netflix paid 50. I don't know what the budget on the film was, but Netflix paid 50.
Yeah. If you don't mind.
Yeah. But that's my problem, is you're feeding the beast. You're opening yourself up to...
God Particle sounded like such a cooler movie.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure being on the blacklist, I'm sure it was a much better script than what it ended up becoming. But unfortunately,
It looks like $45 million was the budget.
Yeah.
Which is, wow. I mean, $15 million is what 10 Cloverfield Lane costs.
Right.
That's insane.
And that's the issue there. And it would have had to been more if you would have gotten JJ to come in and do reshoots.
Yeah.
So they were like, there's no way we can, more than likely, that we're going to turn a profit on this. So Netflix was like, we need content. Here you go.
And I mean, it does kind of help. Because Cloverfield, while the movies might not be the greatest... or even awesome, they have a cool brand, and Netflix attaching itself to that brand, it kind of gives it a little bit more prestige in the long run of thinking that, you know, they might get the next one. Cloverfield might get the next Cloverfield.
Four is already done and shot.
That's okay. That's true. Who has that right now?
As of right now, still Paramount released.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. But I mean, I just think that you're putting yourself in a position where you're empowering your enemy.
Yeah, it is weird that they would do that for them. I don't know. Maybe they don't see... They can't be dumb enough to not see them as a threat.
Well, they're Paramount. They're in a bad position because they have no franchises. Like, Star Trek right now is outside of this Tarantino craziness. Yeah.
Which I do think... I guess we'll talk about the Disney thing. I kind of think Tarantino's doing this to get back at them for what Disney did with his Hateful Eight thing. How they pushed him out of his favorite theater... premiere, he sounded so mad about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Turtles franchise is dead again. Oof. The Transformers franchise is, you know, going through a reboot with Bumblebee's movie with Knight directing, going from Leica and stop motion to a Transformers movie, which is good because now I at least know that I will get a Transformers movie with a plot.
You're right. I did not realize they really don't have anything. They've got Indiana Jones. They've got Beverly Hills Cops.
Had Indiana Jones.
Oh. Well, who has it now?
Disney. Disney bought Lucasfilm.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, Indiana Jones is Lucasfilm.
Of course.
So the Indiana Jones 5 that Spielberg's going to do alongside his West Side Story is going to be a Disney.
I'm looking forward to the West Side Story.
If he can
West
get it cast. If he can get it cast.
Mm. Well, yeah.
I mean, he wants to do Spanish leads and he wants to do unknown actors.
Yeah.
And there have been a couple of projects that have come down the line where he's been like, if I can't find the right kid, I'm not doing it.
Which is encouraging.
Encouraging, but I'd love to see him tackle a musical.
Oh, yeah.
Especially one of the few, one of like the top three musicals of all time, with the social relevance of the West Side Story, you know?
Yeah.
So, but all in all, I just think that Paramount's in a bad situation, so that makes it even more puzzling to me as to why.
I don't know.
They would feed the beast.
I have no idea.
So let's move on to that Disney and Fox deal.
Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts on the industry allowing themselves to go from 5 to 4 major studios?
What I wrote down is that I think it's kind of too early to put like a really tough stand, and I think there's good stuff that'll come from it, just because I feel like Disney could, with different branches, and I feel like they'll come out with different branches, because I mean they'll want to be producing stuff in the vein of 20th Century Fox to be able to put out rated R interesting awards material.
Well, Fox Searchlight isn't going away.
Yeah, that is very worrying. That's one thing I'm very worried about. What are they going to do with Fox Searchlight?
They've already said they're going to leave it alone.
Okay, well, I will trust them then. Well, I mean, are we supposed to trust them? I'm not just going to...
Well, look at what we've done, what they've done with Marvel and with Lucasfilm and with Pixar. Mm-hmm. They all operate, they all have their own head. They all are out producing their own content. The only major difference is Disney is helping with the marketing, and they have, like, if there's a dispute, Disney steps in and has final say.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they all have their own heads. They all operate pretty much autonomously, and, you know, they're left to do their own thing. I remember when the announcement was made right before Iron Man 2 came out that, like, Disney's bought Marvel. And it's like, oh, my God, they're going to mousify the MCU and that this is going to be horrible. All it really meant was that you went from being bankrolled by a hedge fund that you had put together with pennies and dollars of your investors to now you're backed by Disney money.
Yeah.
And so you can do an Avengers movie that has a $200 million budget because Disney.
Yeah. And in general, I'm not worried about the quality of anything. I'm not worried about the whole thing about how everything will be Disney-fied. I don't really know what that means. I understand what people are saying when they say that. I'm not really sure there's anything to point to that shows it happens.
Miramax and Touchstone were putting out, you know, edgy content back in the 90s.
Yes.
So, and they were both owned by Disney. So, I mean...
And they know what to do. Right. Most people, whenever they realize that Touchstone is owned by Disney, people are kind of surprised by that because it doesn't feel anything like Disney. Like, it's not... No one... They're not just going to try and make everything kid-friendly. I don't really like how opposed they are to rated R content. I hope they don't, you know, turn that down. The only thing I'm really worried about is, well, no, and if they do leave Fox Searchlight alone, then that'll be good. And I feel like the only thing to be worried about really is the type of things that they did with the critics and with journalists, how they kind of sometimes...
The LA Times,
Yeah, they try and use journalists sometimes as an extension of their PR arm instead of using them as, you know, treating them just like journalists.
Which is something that goes back to the studio system era of Hollywood, where it's like you've got reporters on the payroll to put out good stories and bury bad stories about you.
Right. Like, everyone thinks they already do that. Everyone thinks they're paying critics to do good things with The Last Jedi. I mean, they're not right now, but...
Yeah, fanboys are crazy, but right, that's okay. Yeah. Look, my main thing is that I think what most people are upset about is that it's Fox. And Fox has this long, long, long library that goes all the way back to the 30s.
Are we still going to get that intro?
I believe so. I mean, that's what they do with Marvel. Yeah. Marvel still has there's no Buena Vista Entertainment, you know, castle with an arch going over it. If in front of any of the Marvel movies or any of the Star Wars movies, so I would assume...
If what they're going to do is make a streaming service so that I can have the whole back catalog of 20th Century Fox
and Disney.
If they can do that, I'm on board. I'll give them $30 a month so that I can have all of that. I'll cancel Netflix. Like, if they're really going to start doing that, then I think Netflix should
be worried. Well, the streaming service is coming in 2019. They've already started greenlighting content that to be produced exclusively for the streaming service that... For example, that Young Merlin series that Ridley Scott was talking about doing.
Oh, the first movie. They were greenlighting it?
They were greenlighting that specifically for, they've already shot a few things specifically for the streaming service, is coming in 2019.
Yeah.
They were going to buy somebody up to get content. And I feel like if they'd have bought up Sony, which is hemorrhaging money all the time, if they'd have bought up Sony, yes, Sony has Columbia TriStar, which their back catalog goes almost as far back as Fox's. I don't think the public outcry would have been nearly as severe as what it was when they were like, we're going to buy Fox.
Yeah. And I feel like someone like 20th Century Fox, which is still good, I hope someone buys up. Well, I don't know if someone will buy up Sony. Sony is, every now and then they get good stuff, but, you know.
They're... Sony's Pictures Classics does a really good job.
Oh, they're great. Don't they, aren't they doing Call Me By Your Name?
Yeah, I think so.
They.
But they yeah. they produce good content. But they like do. Mainstream
Driver was very good.
Mainstream Sony is like, right. Yay, Jumanji made us $900 million and bailed us out this year.
Yes.
Yay.
That's very true.
Because otherwise we would have been like fifth out of the Power Five.
Yeah. What was... Oh, goodness. I forgot what I was going to say about... Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Like, I just think that if they'd have bought Sony, they would have gotten Spider-Man fully back. They wouldn't have had to worry about anything else.
Yeah.
And... Like, they would have gotten all the Columbia TriStar backlog, which includes Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been enough content to put on your streaming service. And I think that people would have been less upset. You buy Fox, you buy their sports properties, you buy their TV arm, so that FX and FFX are now under your control. Hulu's now under your control, which will be the bare bones of the streaming service that you create.
Yeah.
And you buy all their back catalog since the 1920s, it just seems like you're conglomerating a lot more power than what you had if you'd have bought Sony.
Yeah. And I think it'll also be nice to have places like Sony maybe struggle, maybe not do so well in the next few years, maybe have to go bankrupt. That'd be kind of cool if they went away. And it could make studios like A24, Focus Features, things like that start coming up more and start getting their shit together, and they can actually in the next 20 years have new studio heads that produce interesting content.
There was, I believe, don't hold me to this, but there were rumors that A24 was included in the Fox deal.
Huh.
So there were rumors. I saw tweets, but I'm not entirely sure that that's accurate. But A24's been, Free Fire is freaking amazing. Like, A24 has been doing really great content.
Oh, yes, Free Fire was amazing. Last time you brought that up, I also didn't remember what you were talking about. I don't know why.
Because no one saw that movie.
Oh, no.
Brie Larson set in a single warehouse with a kind of a whodunit, not 12 Angry Men, what was that? Dirty Rotten Scandals type of feel to it.
Huh. It looks... Well, okay, on Reddit, somebody said that Disney to buy Fox, as well as indie studio A24. That's what I'm seeing. I don't know if that actually...
But that's what I'm saying. I'm not sure it's accurate, but I've heard that. Which, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're buying Fox Searchlight that you would also want A24.
And, yes, it does look like, you know, people are... I understand why it's scary that Disney is going to be owning so much content. But, I mean, for the last 100 years, almost every... major brand that we have in our houses. Like, it's not like there are really 200 brands. There are 200 brands that are owned by two brands. Like, isn't it like almost every pair of sunglasses that you're going to buy are owned by one company, but you think there are a bunch of other companies? Like, all the makeup is owned by one company. It's not... I don't think this whole, you know... It's big because it's movies, and we all love movies, and this deal is out in the public eye. I don't think it's that as scary as
we
it sounds.
We want more places for... free-spirited filmmakers to go and get financing and be able to put their visions to the screen.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's also exciting some with Netflix, that we can actually have films in film festivals. And I hope Netflix starts going to Tribeca and Cannes, things like that. And we can get movies immediately that we can see. Interesting content that we can see.
Which is their big issue with, you know, Amazon will delay their shit.
Yeah.
Amazon will delay their shit.
They do a very good job with the way they do it. They'll put it in theaters and you'll get it soon.
Which is why Manchester by the Sea was able to make a qualifying run for the Oscars, but Beast of No Nation was not. Because Netflix is like, we are doing day in, date.
Right.
And theater owners look like, screw you.
Right.
No one's going to come to our theater. They're just going to sit at home and watch it. So screw you. And Amazon's over here like, 2 month window.
Still, Beast of No Nation was a beautiful movie. I would have loved to see that on the big screen.
Indeed. So we talked a little bit about Cloverfield Paradox, and the word of mouth of that was not good after everybody saw it. But,
right.
But they already bought the thing. Like, they already saw the thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, Netflix achieved their end. A lot of people didn't like it. Which brings me to this. What makes a bad movie a bad movie? Like, we talk all the time about cinema. We started this podcast by talking about how cinema is a matter of interpretation and personal perspective. What makes a bad movie a bad movie?
Well, the other day I went to see Casablanca was playing at Movie Tavern, and I mean I adore that movie. That movie is brilliant, and every shot and every moment, every musical cue is packed with different motivations, different schemes put by different characters. It is incredibly, it's not layered based on what's going on in the story. The story is pretty simple, but everything that happens happens for a distinct reason, and that reason is at the forefront. And now, even okay movies don't have as much layering as something like that, and that's fine. Like, you know, a movie doesn't need to be, like, that's why Casablanca is amazing, because it has that every moment.
Citizen Kane the same way.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Like, and it's, that movie is innovative, and even today, the camera movements, the style of that movie, the acting feels as fresh as Lady Bird or any other big release that's come out this year. And even movies that are okay, you know, they have some sense of that. They don't have as much, but, you know, you get into things like budgets, and, you know, the director might not understand the nuances of the characters or camera moves or things like that. I would say that a bad movie just lacks all of that completely. And the motivations that come in bad movies are almost silly sometimes. And that's what I think. That's what, when you asked that question to me the other day, I didn't know what to say. I think that might be where my mind goes first.
My mind goes to a film like Movie 43, where it has a whole...
That movie is just cynical. That movie is so cynical.
It's satire, actually. Yeah. But
oh, I see.
It's basically satire. But, like, you're just putting... Like monster trucks. You're putting something out that someone somewhere along the way thought would be a good idea, but things got out of hand, and now you've got this thing on your hands that you have to take a huge write-down on because there's no way you're going to make your money back on it.
Or even, yeah, like I didn't see Monster Trucks. Did you?
I did, yeah.
So it was really that bad?
It was an okay...
I mean, it looked bad. The commercial looked bad.
I'm a guy who got excited because I'm a kid of the 90s. I got excited to go see Harriet the Spy. Nickelodeon Studios was doing decent stuff.
Oh, yeah. Nickelodeon Studios was really cool.
Nickelodeon Studios was doing really interesting stuff in the late 90s. Uh-huh. But, like, this is what Nickelodeon kind of does. And I think that if Monster Trucks would have come out in 1999, I think everybody would have been kind of okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like, you know, we've moved on. Pixar has raised the bar for what a kid's movie could be and should be. Someone would argue that Illumination is taking a dip back down.
Have you seen those trailers to the new Grinch movie?
I have.
It is so sad.
I have not, but this is the same studio that gave me Secret Life of Pets, which is Toy Story with dogs. So, yeah. I mean...
That was a fun movie. It was a very fun movie.
But, I mean, it's the same plot.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, like, to me, the concern that I have is that we're doing in that particular instance, it's like, we're just trying to make something so that we can put it out in theaters so that we can make some money off of it. And one thing leads to another, and oversight gets lost, and you end up with a ballooning budget and production overruns, and you end up with a movie that now it's almost impossible for you to make money off of.
Yeah.
And then everybody comes in to try and rescue it, and you've got 15 cooks in the kitchen, and then there's right. no way that you get...
Well, yeah. And then that's the point where some of the people on the production that are trying to put out something that has a quality story, while another half of the production is trying to just put something out that's going to make a bunch of money. No one has a clear goal.
But to me, that comes back to whoever the greenlighting producer is.
Uh-huh.
I'm helping you finance this thing. My ass is on the line. We're going to do that. Like, we're going to try and Because there are certain directors, you give them no oversight, you're going to end up with craziness. And if you provide...
That story about Terry Gilliam working with the Weinsteins on Brothers Grimm.
Yeah.
Like, they gave him... They're like, you're Terry Gilliam, do what you want to do. And then they saw the stuff and they're like, no, 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 no. And that movie turned out to... They were fighting all the time. It turned out to be really bad.
Right. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, what makes a bad... No one sets out to make a bad movie. Michael Bay does not set out to make a bad Transformers movie. He happens to, but he doesn't set out to.
And I'm sure that he probably has a goal that it accomplishes pretty, you know, which is entertain 15-year-old kids, but do it with a ton of money. I remember wanting to go see the second Transformers movie when it came out. That was exciting for me as a little kid. It sucks. I mean, it was bad.
But, like, no one sets out to make a bad movie.
Oh, yeah.
But they happen. And a lot of the times they tend to happen when there's no oversight or when, you know, a person who needs to be reined in a little bit is allowed to have free rein.
Mm-hmm.
And then you try and come back and correct, and then you add reshoots, and then, you know, reshoots are pretty standard for big movies, but not, you know, $100 million reshoots.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've heard some directors talk about how they'll be planning the reshoots as they go along just because it'll finesse the movie a little bit. It'll make it... But yeah, like with the Justice League thing, how many reshoots, how many millions of dollars of reshoots did that thing have?
4 months. It's the same way with the Solo movie. You know, Lord Miller with 2 weeks left to go, and then turn around and hire Ron Howard, and they both ended up shooting about the same amount of time, 4 months apiece.
And I think if the Solo movie's good, I think that will probably change a lot of people's opinions on the Fox deal, because that was a thing that people were really worried about. If they pull it off, if they make a good movie from that, that's going to change a lot of people's attitude of them. I think it will.
I think that...
I mean, if it's bad, then yes, that's only going to get worse for their public image.
I think there's no way you can win with the fan base on a Solo movie.
That's probably pretty true. That's one thing about Disney I like. They don't care about giving the middle finger to the fans.
Yeah, they don't, but they also know where that line is.
Yeah.
And, you know, Feige... They took a lot of heat for Iron Man 3 and the way that they treated the Mandarin, and the fan base got really upset. You know what they did? They came back 6 months later with a one-shot that said, no! Forget everything you read or saw. The Mandarin, the real Mandarin, is actually still out there. We'll never see him, but the real Mandarin is still out there, because they realized they had created a fire, and they needed to tamp the fire down just enough so that they could move on to the next thing. And, you know... A lot of Iron Man 3 is divisive because it just feels like something that's completely different because you have a Shane Black doing it.
Yeah. That was a pretty interesting move on their part. That was pretty cool. I thought that was pretty cool. I wasn't a huge fan of that movie, but it was a ballsy move.
Especially post-Avengers. You're directly following up the Avengers.
Yeah, that's true. Ooh, I remember that trailer coming on all the time, the Iron Man 3 trailer.
A Christmas movie in May.
Yeah.
And now we get to see Shane Black's Predator. Which should be awesome.
Predator, that character has, you know, been given a bad rap for the last few years.
Yeah. So let's end this podcast with some talk about a Disney property, a Marvel property. Black Panther looks like it's going to be a cultural event. Your thoughts on the projections for $165 million opening weekend and what that would mean for the MCU and for the character in general and, you know, the culture.
Well, I think that's really exciting. I thought that the exciting thing about Thor was how it was a completely different world, and it looks like Black Panther is going to be even more of a different world. Like, it's a culture that exists. It's a culture that looks and sounds like it's going to be represented wonderfully. And I think it'll be an example of, you know, the fight that we have in America now about inclusion and things like that. And so many people don't like that because they feel like it's just being sensitive. I think Black Panther is going to be proof as to why it's important to have diversity and inclusion, because we get new, exciting voices. I'm excited to see a world that I don't know be represented in a way that sounds like it's going to be fun and exciting. And it sounds like they're going to reap the benefits of it, because what, the movie was $200 million to make, and they need to make double that. They've already made more than a quarter of that before the movie's even come out.
I think, like... The thing that people don't understand is, like, there has been this real thought out there for years that films that have women in lead roles and people of color in lead roles don't make money. and in with people of color, and like
this is like an all color cast
with the like two exceptions. But like the thing is, like, the only other time I can remember Africa and people from Africa being depicted in a positive light, where they weren't either being put on boats to be sent back here to America and be slaves, or they weren't slaves struggling, you know, in the America of the Civil War, or where they weren't drug dealers and gang members. The only other time I can remember that really happening on a major level was Coming to America, where that first 30 minutes of Coming to America is set in Africa. And it's a really rich, empowered, you know, African prince who is longing to come to America. And once James Earl Jones's king shows up to America to get his son, he is treated with dignity and respect and honor. And, you know, that's the only other time I can think of, like, a positive image of African Americans in a powerful state coming from their from Africa has been depicted. And, you know, the two films are 30 years apart. So I can very easily see why this is a huge cultural moment for them. It's the first African-American superhero to have his own movie since Blade, and none of those Blade movies really took off in the way that they could have if they were done now.
I have not seen any of the Blade movies.
Del Toro did a Blade movie, Blade 2.
I am really behind on Del Toro's back catalog. Speaking of bad movies, I haven't seen Mimic. I've heard that's really bad.
Yeah. That's not still not as bad to me as Alien 3, but that's just me.
I enjoy Alien 3 for some... I mean, when I watch it, I know that it's bad.
Yeah.
It's a guilty pleasure. But I am so excited for Black Panther. I think it's going to be awesome. I'm excited that they have characters who don't even... They have African accents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's brave, and I think it's going to pull off.
And I think Ryan Coogler is one of the most talented directors working today, and I think Michael B. Jordan is one of the best actors working today. And I think that Chadwick Boseman has a really good sense about him, and it's going to work. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they do, what they bring to the cinematic universe.
Me too. And I was kind of down on Marvel, and especially 2015-16. I thought it was kind of boring. I completely, even passively, gave up on it. But this year's been great. It feels like they are great. They've convinced me that they're great, and I'm excited to see the new one.
I am too. All right, so that'll about do it for this week's podcast. Once again, promote yourself, promote Real Friends, promote...
Nathan Velasquez. You should listen to 104.5 ESPN on weekdays, 7 and 9. You also watch Real Friends either on YouTube or go to 1045ESPN.com/Real Friends. Also, check out foxtailproductions.com. That's my production company. And that's all the shameless promotion that I'll do.
And also hashtag chalk up.
That's hashtag chalk up. I forget it all the time. I forgot it just now. That's a good opportunity to do that.
All right. That'll about do it. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at BCW Tiger Fan.
Nathan Vell 812.
All right. That'll about do it. Thank you very much, and have a pleasant afternoon.